1, 2, 3, 4.
The people that we choose to love and that we choose to rely on and trust. I think you really hit the nail on the head when you mentioned Marissa and Jenny's relationship and that female friendship. And that's what we watch happen in the series in real time. Whereas the marriages and the relationships that they're already in maybe aren't so perfect, but the one we watch them choose in the series is the one that's the most rewarding. It's been so nice to listen to people's reaction to that relationship and how real that relationship feels, and how these two women, from a character perspective, have every reason to not get along or to hate each other or to yell at each other. And it's the opposite of what each one of them does. And that just feels real and true to me and honest. I know a lot of women who I feel would act that, be that way, be the best version of themselves in such an awful situation.
We're at times where a lot of the arts are really suffering in multiple countries with funding and cost of living. Understandably, people come for the arts. But, you know, our job is at times to hold a mirror to society. We can learn a huge amount. It can really change everyone's perspective. So look, it could be escapism, and we all need that at times, but it also can have something that fundamentally can't be enacted just through journalism at times. I think when you dramatize something, it can reach the very core of an audience.
Today, we'll be talking about the intense emotional toll of modern life and how the deepest secrets often hide behind the most polished facades. My guests have dedicated their careers to crafting psychological dramas. Nigel Marchant is the managing director and an executive producer at Carnival Films, the powerhouse behind some of television's most beloved and intricate dramas, from Downton Abbey to the television adaptation of The Day of the Jackal. Megan Gallagher is a writer who understands the delicate mechanics of suspense and the human heart. She created and wrote the critically acclaimed series Borderliner, and most recently, the BBC thriller Wolf. They've joined forces for the new limited series All Her Fault, now streaming on Peacock. It's an anxiety-inducing thriller adapted from Andrea Mara's novel, and the show plunges us into the frantic world of a wealthy working mother, Marissa Irvine, after her 5-year-old son disappears. Starring Sarah Snook in her first television role since Succession, the series starts with a rupture when Marissa's son Milo is kidnapped and ripples into many lives, exploring mom-shaming, the guilt, blame, and sacrifice of motherhood, and what happens when domestic bliss turns to domestic misery. Nigel and Megan, welcome to the creative process.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So congratulations on All Her Fault. It addresses all these serious issues about our shared responsibility and parenting today. I often feel you don't know people until the bottom has fallen out of their lives. And this happens right at the start of the show when Marissa Irvine's child is kidnapped. And I would have thought, oh, that's just about the worst thing that could happen to a mother. But from there, it's a long ride down to the basement. Mm. There's so many levels on the way down. Could you just walk us through some of those levels?
Oh, gosh. I definitely don't want to give all the spoilers away, but I think that anybody who started the show or even just seen the trailer knows that Milo goes missing. Of course, he's been kidnapped. The only thing that could make that situation worse is what we really focus on, which is the why of it. Why did he go kidnapping, and who around you might have had a hand in it or be involved in it in some way? So that is the big question of the series. And that's what we're with Marissa through for the season, is sort of the why did this happen? And the answers therein are pretty sucker punching.
Indeed. And Nigel, you know, as a producer, you're no stranger to these complex dramas. What were the key elements that drew you to the story?
We'd read quite a few different thrillers. We were looking in this area, what we could find Megan next. We'd worked on a couple of pieces in development, and they hadn't got greenlit or hadn't quite made it, as is often the case with what we do. And so we were looking for something in this kind of genre. And, you know, it's finding something that has a brilliant opening premise that is very immediate, and this novel really had that. And then a brilliant end as well, something that felt satisfying to an audience who sat through 8 hours of a show. So looking for those two parts, and then also finding something to say about the world we're living at the moment. So I was trying to find those three different pieces, and then really have a show that had a thriller to it, had the twists and turns and leaned into that genre, but also a family drama that we could really explore those characters. So it was looking for all of those different ingredients.
Yeah, a family drama. And it's really about female friendship as well. I mean, so many things. And I thought, you know, going into, as you say, really satisfying editing, I thought, I know what this is about at first. It's about, it kind of charted it, but no, it really does turn many times. I think that it does ask those huge, difficult questions about love and sacrifice. I mean, marriage is messy enough. And then all the flaws and resentment emerges when things like this go wrong. And I think it really lifted the veil on the normalcy. And then it made me ask questions about who we choose to trust and love. Like sometimes it's just accidental, the people that you form your long-time relationships with, or the people who, you know, choose to trust and love for your children. It made me a bit paranoid. I don't have children, but we've all been in these parenting roles, which you also address from many perspectives.
I think what's really nice, you're talking about the people that we choose to love and we choose to rely on and trust. I think you really hit the nail on the head. You mentioned Marissa and Jenny's relationship and that female friendship. And that's what we watch, you know, happen in the series in real time. Whereas the marriages and the relationships that they're already in maybe aren't so perfect, but the one we watch them choose in the series is the one that's the most rewarding. It's been so nice to listen to people's reaction to that relationship and how real that relationship feels, and how these two women, from a character perspective, I won't give too much away, but we get there quickly in the pilot, but they have every reason, you know, from a story setup perspective, to not get along or to hate each other or to yell at each other or something like that. And it's the opposite of what each one of them does. And that just feels real and true to me and honest. I know a lot of women who I feel would act that be that way, be the best version of themselves in such an awful situation. So it just felt so real and true to me. And people seem to be having such a great reaction to it.
Yeah, it was really important to us to kind of not pit the two women against each other. I think we often see that in television, and what we don't explore is that friendship. So we really didn't want to put any shade on those characters at all and explore that friendship. And that there's many types of marriages in many ways, and they find strength from each other that they're not getting from their husbands.
Yeah, indeed. They can, those friendships can sometimes be among the longest, right? They can last us through our many marriages and divorces. And I think, you know, I just wanted to say, at first when I went into watching, I thought, oh, this is so fast paced. I could almost not keep up. But then as I understood it, you were giving space to explore all these perspectives on parenting, whether it's the exhaustion of working parents or what it feels like to raise a disabled child. And so then this excited my mind. What happens when the eldest child steps in to be a parent to their younger siblings? And what about these other in-between parents and nannies? You honor all these different roles and foster parents and other caregivers. And even the determined detective Alcaraz, played by Michael Pena, he even acts parentally towards the victims. He's not just trying to solve the crime. He's want to make sure that they're not traumatized themselves. And he has his own issues behind the scenes. And then we explore rescue fantasy. There's a weird, without giving too much away, there's a weird kind of Munchausen by proxy plot and what happens when love goes too far. So I felt like everyone is kind of a parent in this story, even if they don't have children. And at the same time, they all felt like also parents who need parenting themselves.
I really like that. I hadn't heard it phrased that way before. I think that's really great. It's always a huge balance to try to get enough plot to keep, you know, the thriller elements going, which I enjoy very, very much doing as a writer. And I really enjoy developing with Nigel. We've got a kind of a thriller shorthand between us at this point for sure. But enough time for characterization as well. I think the first three episodes set a particular pace that's really, really breakneck. And then somewhere around 4 and 5, we were able to slow it down just a teeny tiny bit and squeeze some emotional juice before we ramp it right back up again. It's always a balance, you know, you do the right amount of this and the right amount of that, but that's also kind of the fun of it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, isn't it? You know, we wanted to be incredibly propulsive. There's a lot of TV out there for all of us. So you wanted to really grab hold of your audience and start the roller coaster with them. And then that middle point, you kind of feel you've earned the right to dig into these characters a little bit more. So hopefully we found the right balance.
Yeah. And going back to the female friendship at the core of the story, I really like how it began. You know, they're strangers, really, but they come together around this point of the exhaustion of motherhood and also the right of women to feel rage. You know, men are often allowed to get angry, but when women do it, they're called hysterical or whatever. You're right to that. And I felt like, yeah, this could really happen. And they really care for each other.
That scene comes from the book, or at least the impetus of that scene comes from the book. So credit to Andrea Marr for sure. But that scene where they're both sort of escaping from that horrid school function and they're in the bathroom and they're in the same dress. It's such a great moment in the book and just something, oh gosh, I would want to escape and I would want someone to bring me a glass of wine.
Yeah, and I feel like we should hear the scene just so we could hear their immediate rapport. So I'll play a clip and I wish we could see their faces on audio because there's a lot of compassion and unspoken complicity in the faces of Sarah Snook and Dakota Fanning in this moment. We've trimmed a bit for time, but this gives you a good sense of the scene.
What are the chances?
Oh my god. Wow. It looks so much better on you.
No, it does not. You look amazing. We both look stunning, but I haven't worn this dress in forever. It's so weird.
Yeah, me neither, actually.
I feel like I've seen you around a bunch of times, but I've never actually. I'm Marissa.
I'm Jenny.
Hi. Your son is in Mr. Williams' class too, right?
Yeah, Jacob. Yours is
Milo.
Yeah.
So weird. You okay? Yeah. You know what? I didn't actually come in here to pee. I just had to escape from out there. It's just so intense. If I brought back two glasses of wine, what would you think?
I'd love it.
Yeah? Yeah. Okay. Let's do that. Okay.
Yeah, and kind of the heart of the story, or certainly their friendship in that pilot episode. And, you know, you can get cocooned into your world in a marriage and having children and at that stage in life. So it's nice to explore that kind of new friendship coming together and that chance meet with somebody that you really connect with. Felt really interesting to us.
Yeah, and it's very comforting to watch because you also say that they're very isolated otherwise. They admit that they're working. When do they have a moment to themselves? And not to bring in your other projects too much, but that reminded me of in Downton Abbey, there was just that wonderful sense of community, even though we don't want to go back to that time. But there were really people working as a family, like a large family unit, looking after each other, making sure the whole household worked. That's what I really enjoyed about that drama. In All Her Fault, in some ways, you're depicting people with new wealth, and they haven't quite worked that out yet. And so they haven't found that web of relationships because there isn't time for that these days.
Yeah, and I think Minky really leaned into that in how she shot the show, of these kind of really big establishers shots, you know, which lent into not only the kind of needle in a haystack with where is Milo, but, you know, our own isolation in these cities. And I think, you know, that speaks into the Irvins. You know, they're a small little unit. And as Marissa's happy in that unit and didn't need to stretch it, but in times of crisis, you know, that's when you need your friends around you and a bigger community.
Yeah, and you spoke a little bit, you're talking about developing that thriller shorthand or, you know, developing your instincts or how you're choosing projects. And Nigel, and as a producer, you're very keen sense of what works and I think very hands-on, you're here today. I'm wondering how you feel you honed your instincts and came to understand, you know, picking the right people to make a project land and how you develop your intuitive intelligence.
I think years of hard work, really, is the honest answer. I came from production. So I was a freelancer for many years and really did the nuts and bolts through every job in production. I started as a runner, worked my way through to production manager, line producer. And then I was really lucky, executive producer Sally Head took a chance on me and made me a producer. And it's quite hard, or certainly back then, to swap from the kind of into the editorial, into the creative. And I really learned from those people, Sally Head, and then when I worked with Gareth, of that development side of the business, that kind of creative editorial. And yeah, you hone your skills. And I think you've got to rely on your instinct and a part of it of what do I want to watch? You've got to be really passionate about anything you're developing. It's a really long process. So, you know, I don't know, Megan, what we've been 3 years probably doing this from kind of beginning to end.
Yeah, honestly, no. if you don't love something, you're going to really struggle partway through.
Yeah. And at the same time, it was being developed. I would also want to know why you felt that Sarah Snook, she was executive producer and she was also having her first child at this time. Actually, you say 3 years, but that actually seems kind of short compared to some projects, really, in their development, that you could get that all done while she's having a baby.
It was, we probably were lucky. It was, as all these things, when the planets align, it's an Irish novel. So we'd adapted it for Dublin. And we'd shared it with our colleagues over at Peacock, really looking at a co-production opportunity. They read it and loved it and were looking for something in this area. And so said, could you locate this in America for us? We think these themes are universal. And it just so happened, Megan was writing it, who's indeed American, though lives in Europe. So it was really serendipitous that those kind of came together. The show got greenlit and we were looking at casting. And it's a really tough role. Marissa is in crisis, emotional crisis for 8 hours. And who could take us through those complexities of emotion? Who do we want to sit there and watch for 8 hours crying? You know, that it takes some kind of extraordinary actress. And we, you know, love Sarah from Succession. And we'd also seen her do Dorian Gray on the stage, which just was a remarkable performance. You know, she played every part. And yeah, so we approached her and it was tough. She was doing 8 shows a week, as you say, had a new child, was extremely busy. But thankfully, her manager had a read of it and loved the pilot episode and was really supportive.
As Nigel said, it's 8 episodes of a woman and in such despair, and hysteria. And I think in an actress who wouldn't be as skilled as Sarah, the crying might come off as just 8 episodes of being a victim. You know what I mean? But because she's so skilled and because she's so interesting to watch and knows how to suck emotional juice and all different kinds of nuances out of things, she's crying. Of course she's crying. Her son is missing, but she's also got this personality that bursts through in every scene. You know, she still can have a snide comment or make a joke or, you know, recognize the irony or something, or upon a dynamic with somebody that existed prior to the kidnapping, all those kinds of things. She's capable of doing so much nuance and balancing so much in a scene. So, we were very lucky to have her and did cartwheels when she signed up.
Yeah. And I think that the emotional exhaustion, of course, she didn't have to fake, you know, you mentioned Dorian Gray. I think she played 26 characters in that.
This was a walk in the park.
Yeah. Hats off.
This is done.
She did it so gracefully. And I think, you know, also to Jake Lacy, who plays Peter Irvine, who kind of blindsided me there as well. I thought, you know, I know what he's up to, but no, I had no idea. He walks this really uneasy line between the desire to protect and the need to control, taking care of his sister and brother and family. How did you approach writing a man whose capacity for taking great care, you know, is wound up in his need for control and the maintenance of a lie?
I was so excited so often. Jake Lacy, he's definitely has some secrets that he's hiding. And when diving into those secrets and the ways at which he's at fault for the mistakes that he's made and his part in the story, I was so interested to dive into his character as a caretaker and as somebody who's really, I think it's fair to say, obsessed with family and being needed and being sort of, as you say, in the parental role. I was so excited to do that with a male character because we so often see that in female characters who are bad people in stories. You know, they're obsessed with relationships or obsessed with children or obsessed with family or something, and it drives them to madness and that kind of stuff. We so often attribute the need for family or the need to take care of people or the need to be a hen. In some way, with being a woman, we don't often associate it with a man. And so I was really excited to develop a male character that way. And I was even more excited when Jake Lacy signed on because he's such a masculine guy. You know what I mean? He's such a strapping masculine guy. And I think he did a fabulous job of tapping into all that. I think he is surprising audiences who've seen the show.
Yeah. And addressing that really important thing, whether it is, as you say, most often women, but when mothering becomes smothering, and is that really care? At one point, it's maybe my favorite turning point in the series. It's towards the end of, I think, episode 5, and things are really coming to a boil. And Peter says what he loves most about his son are when he has nightmares and needs to be comforted. I mean, that's just effed up.
We went back and forth on that line, Nigel, if you recall.
I absolutely do. It is the most terrifying thing. And it's great you had that response because, you know, Megan had set herself a real task on that episode. She wanted to do a real chamber piece and set it all in the house and just keep turning the temperature up, which I think is so much fun. It's such a discipline to be able to do that as a writer. And when you watch it, you don't feel that, oh, we're not going outside. It doesn't feel to an audience immediately that we've set it all in the house, and great for actors. So it was a really fun episode for Megan to write and for us to film. And you're exactly right. That line is utterly terrifying and says everything about that man. You know, when we first got the script and Megan delivered the script, it was really good fun. You were like...
But we wondered if it was too much, is it too little? And it came down to Jake's performance. I think he did it perfectly. I think he delivered it like what he thought he was saying was just a completely normal answer. I think that's why it works. I think he made it work perfectly. So credit to him.
Yeah. And I think it's just a very extreme version. I think of things that we may have all felt, whether we are parents or whether we're kind of in a kind of caretaker role, is that you want to give a kind of pure love or that's unconditional, or you want to, he really wants to be the parent that he never got to receive, that kind of love. And well, in a very strange way.
And I think it's one of the more surprising twists I've seen lately in this genre. So Nigel, earlier you touched on your ongoing partnership with Universal International Studios and how you're developing shows and your new lineup.
I think what Fault did was bring in virtually every part of the studio, which was brilliant to see. So we, you know, kind of developed the show. We worked very closely with the international studio that we're part of. So our colleagues, Kelsey and Margaret over in the US, and developed the whole show. We go out to the marketplace, Peacock, which is our streaming channel over in the US, you know, bought the show. And then when we got Sarah attached, she had a very, very narrow window. We talked about she'd done Dorian Gray in London. She wanted to take it to Broadway. She wanted to go home and promised her husband a break. So she was like, yeah, look, I'll do this, but can we shoot it in Melbourne? So you then get into a place of, okay, we're meant to be Chicago. Do Chicago and Melbourne go together? I've been to neither country. So, you know, quickly visited both of them and they were a very good match. That worked out. So then you're in a position of, all right, we've got to shoot it in Melbourne. And we used Matchbox down there, which is also part of the international studio. So it was really bringing all these pieces together. So Carnival itself still runs as a kind of independent at heart outfit. We're a small team. There's only 20 of us at Carnival, but we have this big studio behind us, which really is a huge benefit to us. And, you know, this show brought all of those pieces together. And it was really the first time Carnival had done an American show that was set in America. We'd made network television before, but this was America for America. So it was a really important piece of business for us and was benefited by all these different parts of the studio.
Are you planning to speak about your project, another large tableau like Downton Abbey in America? I don't know, because you're so good at plate spinning. I will just be curious, you know, what that would be in the American scene.
We wouldn't do a kind of Downton. I think you've got that with A Gilded Age, which obviously my colleague, partner Gareth produces on that. Certainly looking at making inroads, why wouldn't you look at that market? It's the biggest marketplace and, you know, opening opportunities there. And certainly the relationship we have with Peacock has been brilliant. They were great partners with us. They were a really smart team over there. And obviously we do Day of the Jackal with them as well. We love that relationship and it makes a lot of sense within our business model to making shows for a network or broadcaster within the family. That said, we can work with anyone. It's certainly, hopefully this is a great kind of testament to Carnival's work. And it feels very, you know, we look at what is entertaining, what is global, what themes travel. So wherever they're set, they're the things that we're looking at of really grabbing an audience.
I mean, the big question, I think, on a lot of people's minds, too, is how is AI changing the way we're telling stories, the pacing of story, just the whole, I mean, how does that work into your process?
As you've seen this morning, I'm not sure if I can make the laptop work. Absolutely none for me.
Yeah, I pretend it doesn't exist. That's my day-to-day, honestly. I'm grateful to the WGA for fighting to keep it out of the contract process. But beyond that, I'm not involved in AI at all. I'm kind of grateful that I don't have to be necessarily.
No, that's great to fight it. But I do wonder about how it's changing our attention spans and the way it's changing audiences, too. The way it's changing the algorithms, even production companies that are seeing what stories work or it's trending. I reflect on all those things.
Yeah, look, I think the algorithms, definitely. The marketplace is very cautious at the moment. And there is a lot of content out there. So trying to find something that will punch through is everyone's goal. Budgets have got very high. And I think we're seeing, you know, a reduction in that. But I think all these things pass. This too will pass. And I think audience, they're quick to find when things are a little cynical, I would say, where you keep kind of turning out shows that are all the same or spinning off hundreds of different variations. So, you know, there's a safety at the moment. I hope that will change.
Yeah. And for what you both do and building this tension, I think that can't be done with any kind of machine learning. It has to have that unified voice. So I'm wondering how, you know, in the writing process of All Her Fault or even in Borderline, you just take us into those rooms, the writing rooms, you know, your other collaborators, how you're outlining. It's kind of a mysterious process for us.
Oh, I had a wonderful experience with the writers on All Her Fault. By leaps and bounds, the best episode writers I've ever worked with. There were three of them, James Smythe, Phoebe Claire Powell, and Cam Rogera. They were instrumental in getting the series where it was. I went in with an outline to present to them because I think it's really important to say, okay, this is sort of what I want to do. Help me make it better, as opposed to walking in the room and saying, so what should we do? It's a little bit too open and it's a little too, you know, there's too many possibilities. So you need to walk in with some sort of a vision, but then you need to be really open-minded about what in your vision is working and what isn't. And you often learn a lot of things aren't necessarily working, but it's so constructive and so helpful. So we had a couple of weeks, I think, at the beginning, after we were greenlit or when we were waiting for the green light, I think. I had written episode one, I had an outline for two, and then I had a really detailed outline for two. And then I had a Word document series outline for the rest of the pilot. Those writers were just absolutely, I just would have been completely lost without them. Just amazing. We started a WhatsApp thread, which James named All Our Fault. We've just kept in communication and there's phone calls and we still to this day talk and enjoy each other's company. They're wonderful. I know I said it multiple times, but it's true. I'd be lost without them. So very grateful to them.
And one character that I'm fond of, Detective Alcaraz, played by Michael Pena. I feel this also touches on some elements in Borderline. Just what he said about raising a disabled child, it really rang true. I was just wondering what your research process was in, you know, because there's a lot of compassion for what he's going through.
It was very easy, the research for this one. I have a disabled child. So it was 100% just, I have a nonverbal, the very disabled child who would be in care for the rest of his life. You very rarely see that depicted on television in any kind of real way. You very rarely see depicted honestly if you do. So I pitched this. This felt like the right story and the right way to do it in a series that's generally quite critical of men and their lack of involvement in the household. It felt not only like the right thing to do, but also the honest thing to do to balance that with at least one episode that says, here's a fabulous dad. And here's a fabulous dad dealing with one of the most complex and emotionally difficult situations you can be in as a parent. Like, it's not a normal situation. It's harder. And he's still just kicking butt at it. You know what I mean? And it just felt like the right time to use that well of personal experience that I have. And basically, Detective Alcaraz is my husband. I mean, just be totally honest. My husband is that involved and that caring and that loving and that on top of it. And he knows the names of all the kids and the names of all the teachers and the every doctor's appointment and everything. You know, he's really on top of it. So men like that exist and families like that exist. And what I think Mihi did really well, which I'm only appreciating in layers as I keep kind of seeing these clips on social media and stuff like that, is she managed to, is one thing what I put on the page, it's another thing how she directs it. And she directed it in a way of, yeah, this is a really emotionally exhausting situation and it's difficult and it's tolling, but they love their kid and their kid's awesome and their kid smiles and they have dinner together and it's beautiful. And these classroom full of kids might be disabled, but they're really cute too. And they're really great. You know what I mean? There was no victim sorrow in that sense. she really captured, I think, the love and the tenderness there so, so well. So no, I'm really delighted with that episode. And it definitely comes from my heart, but...
And we had one bit of luck on that, because right at the beginning, Megan said, I've written this character and I've absolutely got Michael Peña in my head. I love him as an actor. And it's so rare that, you know, planets align, that you can actually get the actor and they're available and they're interested in all of those things. So, you know, that was a lovely bit of casting to kind of confirm.
It actually happened. It happened quickly, too. Like, boom, we signed on. It was wonderful. We're so fortunate.
Yeah, and the casting process is great. I think you have the great David Rubin was the casting director. It was so great.
Perfect.
Yeah, bringing these ensembles.
He did an okay job on this one.
You know, and a shout out to Stephen and Brad. And again, talking into our studio, Stephen and Brad do casting over at UCP and also look after us over at the International Studio. And they've been really brilliant colleagues very, very early on. You know, attracting the kind of caliber of cast over the last few shows we've had at Carnival. And they've been instrumental in that. And, you know, introducing David, who was just brilliant.
So wonderful to work with. So good at what he does.
I also wonder, like, when you've written it already, but you have a cast in mind. And I don't know if that then echoes back in the revision process of your writing. Would you, you know, maybe you had another actor in mind, but then someone else comes in. And I don't know how that works in your writing process.
What happened, with the exception of Michael Peña, I don't usually, because it was such an unusually personal thing that I was writing, I did have an actor in mind. To be totally honest, I don't usually have an actor in mind. When I'm block one, usually you film in blocks. So the first portion, in this case, four episodes, goes into production. As a writer, you're usually then working on the second block of scripts, so the 5 through 8. What happens then, and it was really great in this process, is that, of course, you have the actors in your head now. Not only is it cast, but they're literally filming and you're watching rushes coming in every single day. So of course I have Sarah Snook in my head and Dakota Fanning and Jake Lacy and all that. What was really, really nice about that, and it was just such an incredible pleasure, was I could write scenes with my shoulders about 3 inches lower than they usually are, because I know that no matter what, it'll be executed so well, that they'll do it all so well, that almost anything I write, they're going to make fabulous. So there's just this sort of relaxation that comes over you of they're going to knock this out of the park no matter what I do. So, and that certainly is what happened. So no, it's not from the beginning, but generally when you're working on block two scripts, those actors' voices are absolutely.
Yeah, I love that moment in long form television, and not just this show. If I think of The Last Kingdom or Jamestown, other shows we've made where all of a sudden you can tell whether the writers are actually writing for actors and playing into those strengths. And especially on long series, how those characters evolve, that may start as a very small part and they get bigger and bigger because of the strength of that performance. I think that's really fun. I love that moment.
I was wondering about the transition for working on period dramas to these more contemporary stories. I mean, what you enjoy about, you know, all the elements of production and costume and the joy of escaping into that. But then when you're working on something contemporary, how do you contrast them and what do you appreciate about not having to get all these period details?
Yeah. Well, it's weird because I suppose we were known for period dramas. Not that we ever thought that. And, you know, between Downton and then The Last Kingdom and Jamestown, they were all very, very different shows, but were all period. The nature of them being period, they are unfamiliar to all of us. So that helps them travel. It is alien to us all, and that's helpful. And we love making them. I'm fascinated by history and delving into these different times. So it was really fun, but we'd always kind of developed contemporary shows, and it's nice now with Day at the Jackal and Hall of Fall that people are seeing that other side to us. So, you know, I'd always say as producers, we're a broad church. You know, we want to make everything we can possibly. I think we're good world builders at Carnival. I think that's where we, you know, we really excel, and transporting people, it feels very forward. And, you know, as I talked about earlier, I come from production, as does Gareth. So that's the bit we love. We don't want to develop for development's sake. We want to make the shows. And then, you know, you can be on shows for 5, 6 seasons. So you become the kind of custodian of that show. Directors come and go. Even writers on occasion come and go. So you're the person protecting that show, that brand of that show. And that's what I love. I love making telly.
Yeah, and the English aristocracy has been very good to you, I should say. But we're glad that you've gone into this contemporary stories. It also made me think about I know it's a limited series, but it made me think, what would All Her Fault? Let's revisit these characters in 10 years' time. I was just imagining what is happening in their life, because I'm so fascinated in the female friendships and what would occur down the line.
This is going to sound so boring, but it's the honest answer, which is the beauty of a limited series, which is how we've developed this season, of course, is that it is supposed to be sort of wrapped up. You know what I mean? In my mind, Marissa and Jenny are happy and still absolutely still friends. I think the more time that passes, I think Marissa will slowly realize that even though the kidnapping was the worst experience of her life, it was also in many ways the best experience of her life, in the sense that there was a huge silver lining and she understood things about her life that she otherwise would not have understood. I think in time that will hit her. No, I think she, 10 years from now, is going to be happier than when we met her, even before she rang on the doorbell.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, in the writing of it, you know, you're reflecting on all these big themes and, you know, it's so nice that you could honor your own family and your husband. And I guess, how did it make you reflect on your own experiences as a mother, as a child?
I think the thing I learned on each project, but I really, really have learned on this one, especially seeing the reaction to this show, which feels, from a female standpoint, overwhelmingly women. I'm hearing women say, I feel so seen, I feel so seen, I feel so seen. What I'm learning, and always learn again and again and again, is that I'm not a unique snowflake. If I feel something and I experience something, probably other people do. You know what I mean? Like, it's my experiences walking through the world are going to be echoed by others, usually. It's nice to have written something about parenting, about being a working mom, that I thought would resonate with other people, with other women, but boy, oh boy, it's resonating even more than I thought. So that was my experience with this.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. You want a good thriller. The twists and turns and all of those parts that lean into it, I think part of our job as producers is to hold a mirror to society. And this felt very of this time. So I'm really glad, as Megan says, that people have reacted to it. And that alongside the fun of this genre, that it has, you know, it holds a mirror to society to a certain level and has something to say for itself.
And you mentioned people you had learned from coming up and, you know, from every element of production. I mean, I'm wondering what your reflections are, like important teachers in your life and the lessons that they passed on to you.
Yeah, I think you look back and it's a lot of hard work. There's no two ways about that. But a lot of luck in any career, of who you work with, the opportunities that are available at the time, or that you find friendships that you enjoy working with people. There's a huge dollop of luck that goes into your career, you know, and I feel that with Megan, that, you know, we'd done these couple of shows and I'd loved working with her. We get on very well together, I hope. But, you know, it also puts a fire in you because you want to deliver for that person and get a show greenlit and really work with them. So that kind of fire, that drive at times is really, really helpful. You kind of use that fire. But yeah, no, look, I was very lucky. I worked with a number of excellent producers. You know, I talked about Sally Head, who was a groundbreaking producer, Prime Suspect and Cracker shows, still hugely respected in the UK business. And yeah, she was a great mentor for me. I was very lucky. And then, you know, obviously I got to work with Gareth, and we've been, I can't remember, too many years, I think about 15, 16 years plus now we've been working together. And it's lovely to have a relationship and a partnership with somebody else, because your instincts become very similar. You know, I'd say between Gareth and I, 95% of choices, we're the same. So we get a shorthand, and that's really good in a business model, because we, you know, enjoy working together, but we can also, it increases our capacity. You know, we always work together, but someone will take point on certain shows. And it's not all on your shoulders, which is quite a nice thing as well. So, you know, it's a tight team here, and a lot of people have been here a long time within the company, which again is really nice. It's kind of, no one ever leaves. I think I've got two former assistants that are working as freelancers now, you know, who we've seen grow up over the last 15 years, which again is really, for me, very, very satisfying.
Wow, that says something for you and the family you've built. Your world building, family building, it's both what you produce and what you have behind the scenes.
Well, I always say, I don't know if it's loyalty or just the fact I'm lazy, but we do like to use writers and directors and producers. And as you say, it becomes, you know, your family business.
I think they trust you to bring out the best work in them. And that's hard.
And again, on this show, we hadn't worked with Minky since Downton. And it leans into the little bit of luck that goes on with things. We were talking about directors, and it was like, you know, Megan couldn't be down in Australia all the time in that kind of showrunner capacity. And you're looking at the kind of American model and the UK model. And Gareth and I were talking, and he kind of said, oh, we need somebody like Minky who's done both. And the weird thing was, it suddenly Minky was available, which is brilliant. And she was living down in Sydney, which we didn't know. So it was even easy. It's lovely when you reconnect with those relationships as well. And she, you know, she did a brilliant job with them. We couldn't be more pleased with what she did with that first block.
Could you speak a little to the differences between the American and the English model? I mean, how?
Yeah, the kind of American model is much more, I would think it comes from network television, where you were producing 22 episodes a season. It was a real kind of machine, and the lead writer was the showrunner and very much was across everything on the show, the budget, the casting, the post-production, and the writing. To do those many episodes, you had a huge team of writers behind you. In England, we've always had much smaller commissions. You know, the maximum used to be 6 episodes. So you would have a writer who was able to do, possibly write everything, much more singular voice. And I think those kind of two models have come in now with cable television in America, and then with the streamers, there's smaller number of episodes and there is normally smaller teams of writers behind it. It's more authored. And so that in the UK, because the writers would normally work across multiple shows, the producers were much more that person, the kind of editorial boots on the ground and what Americans call non-writing EPs, which is the production company, Gareth and I in the UK. So again, we're very hands-on, and it would feel odd to me to develop a show for 2 years and then get that show greenlit and hand, you know, there's a script and here's the budget to somebody else, go off and make that show. That would be terribly, you know, just dishonest of us to a writer not to be there all through that process with them. So I think the two models have become much closer and merged much more. The UK now writers are across every aspect of production and we work as a team. My job is really to find consensus between supporting our authors of the show, our writer and our director. And there can be numerous different voices, a number of executive producers, a number of studios and broadcasters. My job is to keep that noise away and let our authors do the show that they want to do.
And I like that, the fact that you're hands-on and it's not giving away your baby to be raised by someone else.
He's completely hands-on everything. He does absolutely everything. We would have fallen apart and died without Nigel on this. I know it sounds funny, I'm American and you can hear it in my voice, but I live in Europe and I've made shows in Europe and I am so much more familiar with the European model than the American model. I think if somebody handed me the show singularly and said, go, here's the budget and here, you know, go figure it out, I would just fall into a puddle on the ground. So no, I'm much more used to the European model, but it is exciting to see the mixture, as Nigel said, and to have the chance to be across some other things and to adapt those elements of the American model more.
Yeah, speak to that about, you have an experience of Oslo as well, but also you're right now in UK.
Yeah, I actually live in Norway, but I work primarily in the UK. Yeah. Like Nigel said, there's a host of EPs. Not like there's 40, but there's 5 or 6 or something like that. And I always think that it's Nigel's job to do, well, a million things, but one of them is to make that all go very smoothly as a team and to make sure voices are heard and everybody has a chance to speak and for decisions to come about in an organic way that feel right. And just the whole process just went so smoothly. It just was such a breeze, honestly, all of it. But no, I really like that mixture of, because when you have a director who's an EP, they're more invested in the material. They feel more ownership of the series as a whole. I think that that's hugely important. So as a writer, I'm an EP. And then we have EPs on set. And we, of course, have Nigel. And it's nice when you get a nice group
people like that working together. And I think it makes shows better, personally. I know the show is better because there were more voices, smart voices involved in this.
Yeah. And I'm thinking of Oslo as being a place of beauty and a way to recharge yourself, maybe away from Hollywood. How do you find inspiration from the natural world in your creative process or the kind of world we're leaving the next generation and our present ecological crisis?
Norway is an absolutely gorgeous country. It's a small country. There are 5 million people. That's the whole country. So Oslo, the city proper, not including the large county outskirts, the city of Oslo is about 500,000 people. So it is a city with great restaurants and theater and all that kind of stuff, but it is still a fraction of the size of London or Los Angeles or New York or anything like that. So just in general, the temperature just comes down. I don't mean the literal temperature. I mean, stress and tension and whatnot come down considerably when I'm here. And then anytime you have a chance to get outside of Oslo, we've opened up tax incentives to film in Norway and Mission Impossible, James Bond, Black Widow. Everyone's come here to film because the scenery, it's a session, actually, season four. They filmed a whole bunch of stuff in Norway because it's stunningly gorgeous. I mean, the scenery is second to none globally. It's unbelievable. So it's a wonderful place to sort of disconnect and just kind of get away from the stress and tension. So yes, I love living here personally.
And Nigel?
I'm very fortunate that I have a house down on the coast. So down in Deal in Kent, and I get down there and it's good for the soul, exactly for those reasons of the stress of London. And you can just feel your shoulders go down and breathe. And I love it down there. Even in kind of the bleakest winter, there's a joy down there of that kind of building a fire and a large glass of red wine and feeling those shoulders go down. It's great for the soul. And we all need that at times. The carnival, that next generation, is hugely important to us. Our head of production, Charlotte Ashby, is absolutely pioneer in sustainability. And we're very proud of what we do. She is top of her agenda through all of our shows and introduced things that we do in the UK into Australia, of electric vehicles being used for all of the cast and numerous different things to really bring our footprint down as TV producers. So it is incredibly important to us looking forward into the next generation.
Yeah, I think people don't realize the efforts that the industry is making and has really set out to do go zero emissions or offset emissions. It's leading the way in many ways, as I understand. So just in closing, as you think, we're talking about the future, the kind of world we're leaving the next generation, the importance of the arts today, how it's given your life meaning, what would you like young people to know, preserve and remember?
I think it's hugely important. And we're at times where a lot of the arts are really suffering in multiple countries with funding and cost of living. Understandably, people come for the arts. But, you know, our job is at times to hold a mirror to society, and it can be, we can learn a huge amount in the UK from adolescents or a postman show. It can really change everyone's perspective. So look, it could be escapism, and we all need that at times, but it also can have something that fundamentally can't be enacted just through journalism at times. I think when you dramatize something, it can reach the very core of an audience.
I think Nigel said something earlier about when you were asking about how he learned things and got to where he is now. He mentioned something that I often mention, which is just it's good old-fashioned hard work, you know? And I always think about the people who go into our industry are often the people who feel like they can't do anything else. If they could go off and be happy being a lawyer, they probably would. But they have this bug in them and they really want to write, or they really want to direct, or they really want to produce, and they've got to go do it. But it's so scary when you're young because it's such a hard industry to sustain a career. And that's how I felt when I was in my 20s. But now that I'm in my 40s and I've watched the career trajectory of so many people I know, including my own, I think the biggest key to success is something you have completely total control over, which is good old-fashioned hard work. If you're willing to put in the hard work, it doesn't guarantee anything, but boy, oh boy, does it increase your chances. And so it's more in your control than you think. I wish that I knew that in my 20s. I used to think that there was some magic club I had to get into, or this person I had to make, this connection I had to, you know, make or something like that in order to make it. And all along, it was really just elbow grease that gets you where you need to go. So I'm hoping if I was talking to somebody young today about getting into the arts, I would tell them it's that your fate's a lot more in your hands than you think.
I think that's so important. We often try to look for the miracles, but the miracle isn't us. and time. Give it time. So thank you, Nigel Marchant and Megan Gallagher, for bringing to the screen stories that ask important questions about family, love, modern motherhood, and how we can try to build each other up as opposed to tear each other down. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The Creative Process is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producer on this episode was Sophie Garnier. Additional production support was by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram at Creative Process Podcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.